The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Live from the Space Talk Radio Studios, it's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting live to four continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy, here's the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, Space Show listeners. Welcome to this special Friday morning program. By the way, for 2006, Friday morning programs are going to be routine and part of the weekly Space Show broadcast. A couple of very quick announcements. If you want to call the show, that toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let it ring until it can be answered. You're immediately on the air, but be patient until we can bring you up so that we can talk with you. Email, for those of you who would prefer to contact us that way, dmlivings@yahoo.com, drspace@thespaceshow.com, or you can use thespaceshow@gmail.com. And for those of you on chat, it's either IM, ICQ, or CompuServe. The screen name is all one word, Space Show Chat. Check out our newsletter at our website, thespaceshow.com. The website version is updated every Monday and as needed during the week, and it shows coming events all the way into 2006. And then if you want the short email version mailed to you every Monday, send an email to the Dr. Space address. All of our programs are archived, and they are MP3s, and they're being podcasted. You can do whatever you like with them, burn them, share them with your friends. The only thing you can't do is anything commercial, and you can't edit the text. Visit the Space Show store, and above all, support the Space Show by clicking on that button. We appreciate your help. It's a big undertaking to do the Space Show, and we appreciate any support that you can give us. And remember, the Space Show is a trademark and registered service mark for me, David Livingston. Also remember to hold the date. I'm pushing the National Space Society's 25th annual ISDC conference in Los Angeles, May 4th through May 7th. Also, a couple of days left if you want to enter the contest to send a message to deep space. Read about it at the top of our website. Just click on that button and get your entry in. There's still time to go in and be a winner for the December transmission, which actually goes at the end of this month. For this special program, we're very fortunate to have returning to us James Benson. Jim is the founder of SpaceDev and the company's chief executive officer and chairman of the board. Jim Benson was a successful computer-oriented entrepreneur, having founded both CompuSearch and ImageFast, and then he sold both of these companies in 1995 and retired when he was 50. But after months of research, he started SpaceDev, came out of retirement. SpaceDev is publicly traded on NASDAQ. And the symbol, everybody get a pencil, S, P as in Peter, D as in David, V as in Victor, SPDV. Jim Benson holds a Bachelor of Science degree in geology from the University of Missouri and is also a founder of the nonprofit Space Development Institute, which offered a $5,000 Benson Prize for amateur discovery of near-Earth objects. Jim serves as vice chairman and private sector representative for NASA's National Space Grant Review Panel. He is a member of the American Society of Civil Engineers Subcommittee on Near-Earth Object Impact, Prevention, and Mitigation. And recently, he was appointed to the California Space Authority Board of Directors, and he serves there until December of 2007. Jim, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you?
I'm just great, David. Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. I know there's news with SpaceDev. Why don't we start there and tell us about your merger and what's happening with your company?
Okay, David, thanks very much. Before I get started, I'd like to say that anything I say during this interview on this show is my own opinion and not necessarily that of SpaceDev's. And also, because we are a publicly traded company, I need to read this brief little safe harbor statement. Other than historical information, certain statements made on this call are forward-looking statements within the meaning of the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995 and are based on management's current expectations. Factors that could cause future results to differ materially from such expectations are detailed in the company's filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission. So, having gotten the legal stuff out of the way, happy to talk to you about what's happening in the entrepreneurial space arena, and specifically with Space Dev, and maybe some of the things that I hope will be happening over the next few years. You asked about our merger with the Starsys Research Corporation in Boulder, Colorado. We announced that a few months ago. Essentially, what Space Dev is doing is acquiring Starsys as a wholly owned subsidiary and pretty much leaving management and the employees in place. Starsys is 18 years old. They have about 130 employees. They characterize themselves as the company that makes the things that move in space. And for those of you listening who are familiar with engineering related to space, you know that things that have to move in space are usually very critical and have to work. The assemblies and components developed by Starsys over the last 18 years have been on 200 missions, and they have achieved a 100% success rate. So this is a very strong company, about $15 million in revenues, 130 employees. Last year, Space Dev did about $5 million in business and had 25 employees. We're currently pushing toward 55 employees here in the main company. So we're really looking forward to acquiring Starsys and hope that that closing will be within the next 60 days. The important thing about Starsys is that it will add a whole new area of business to what Space Dev has been specializing in, which has been small, high-performance, low-cost micro and nano satellites and safe, non-exploding hybrid rocket motors for human space transport and for the small launch vehicle we're developing. Starsys adds in mechanisms and assemblies, and we want to move them toward space robotics in a big way. So we think it's very complementary to what we're doing, and the corporate culture is very similar as well.
Do you, you combine facilities, or do they stay where they're located now?
Yeah, Starsys has a fairly good-sized facility. They're very crowded, though. They've been growing so rapidly on the outskirts of Boulder, Colorado, and we'll definitely leave them there. We actually had in our plan three different city or metropolitan areas identified as locations that we would like to have a Space Dev presence in, and the Denver-Boulder area was one of those because even though San Diego is like living in a paradise in terms of the weather, and I'm probably here to stay, it also has a fairly high cost of living, and sometimes it's difficult to get to recruit engineers who have to move themselves and perhaps a whole family to San Diego with a higher cost of housing and living. So having facilities in other geographical locations should open up the door to easier recruiting of experienced and valuable engineers.
If I remember correctly, your roots are out of Colorado, right, Steamboat Springs?
Well, actually, I was born and raised in Kansas City.
Okay.
27 years there, then 22 years in the Washington, D.C. area. And then when I sold my companies in 95, I had bought a home in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, because everybody in the family skis. And I did live in Steamboat Springs for two or three years until starting Space Dev and then moving down here to San Diego.
Yeah, I would think the high cost of doing business in California in general would be a deterrent to.
It's not just the taxes, but it's also just a lot of the laws are not very friendly to businesses, especially small businesses. It makes the whole cost of doing business in California more expensive on top of the cost of living.
You know, absolutely. Has there been any negative impact or feedback or challenges to your merger, or should it just sail straight through?
No, it's just to my knowledge, no. This is just a very complicated acquisition because of the size of Starsys and the number of contracts and employees they have. After all, they are almost three times our size. So even though we have a very strong management team here that I've been building up over the last few years, this is still something that needs to be done, deliberately and with in-depth due diligence, which we've been performing for 3 months. And things just continue to move forward very well, and looks like the relationship is going to be great, and the corporate cultures are close. And, they have a great reputation, and SpaceDev has been successful in everything that we have done to date also. So we're combining two really high-quality small companies, and we think that will... With somewhere in the vicinity of maybe $30 million worth of business and 180 to 200 employees, we think that'll just add to our credibility and our ability to go after and perhaps win even larger contracts than we've been able to in the past.
And you recently had some good press that I read about how you could go to the moon much differently and much cheaper than what the NASA program is all about. Let's talk about that.
Well, David, that was a really fun conceptual design. It was actually the third study in a row sponsored by the Lunar Enterprise Corporation of California and Hawaii. The first phase of the study in, it was 2003, looked at a low-cost robotic lunar lander near the south pole of the moon to set up a small science observatory. And then the second study in 2004 was to look at the a closer look at doing precision landing and hazard avoidance in a small area. So unlike the previous missions to the moon that have landed in the equatorial regions, and they've been able to pick vast stretches of relatively smooth and flat terrain, landing near the South Pole is much more difficult. There are no navigation aids. So that's what the second phase, the second study was about. And then the third study this year was really a fun one because the customer asked us to imagine a practical, low-cost human servicing mission to one of these South Pole robotic observatories. And, you know, we didn't quite know how to approach it in the beginning. And so I drew up a little statement of work that said, we will look at technology that exists today or is currently being developed or that we believe would be ready in time for such a low-cost mission. So essentially what we did then is we're not trying to use any unobtainium or, research and development of, technologies that don't exist because that adds a lot of risk, cost, and schedule problems. So, David, what we came up with was kind of an interesting combination. A lot of stuff has to be lifted off the surface of the Earth to get people to the moon safely and to keep them there for a week. So the first thing you have to deal with is the amount of delta V or the energy required to get all of this stuff into space. And we looked at three different categories of launch vehicles, domestic launch vehicles, foreign launch vehicles, and launch vehicles being developed, most specifically SpaceX Falcon 5 and 9. And it turns out that the most expensive way of getting to the moon is to use domestic launch capabilities. The middle path is foreign launch vehicles, primarily Russian. And the least expensive by far, if they're successful, would be the Falcon 5 and 9. Then we assumed that we would shuttle the people between Earth and low Earth orbit on SpaceDev's proposed Dream Chaser space vehicle based on NASA's HL-20, the Personnel Launch System. Then we would assemble the cargo and propulsion units in geo-transfer orbit for cargo and then propel that to the moon, to lunar orbit, and even remotely land a habitat from Bigelow Aerospace. And then people would go through low Earth orbit because the radiation is lower and it's less expensive to get to LEO. So the people would shuttle back and forth between low Earth orbit and low lunar orbit. And then finally, we looked at landing the people onto the surface of the moon, and we realized that if you have already sent a habitat ahead and it's checked out and waiting there and ready for the people, then why would you want to have a pressurized lander with the self-contained environment, why not go back to a concept in the 60s developed by some of the aerospace companies and just have individual lunar lander, you can think of them as rocket chairs. And, you know, the more we thought about it, the more excited we got. And can you imagine, David, you know, you being in your spacesuit and leaving the capsule around the orbit of the moon and climbing into your rocket chair and strapping in and pushing the button and releasing and then landing yourself close to a habitat, you know, with space and the stars all around you and coming in for landing on the moon. I just think it would be great for imagination and public excitement and getting children involved, you know, youth involved in space again. So in any case, to make a long story short, we think we came up with a very safe and practical system of getting people to the moon and back safely and affordably for less than $10 billion, which is still a heck of a lot of money, but it's only a tenth of what NASA's proposing at $104 billion with the so-called Apollo on
steroids.
Apollo on steroids program.
How plausible is what you're talking about? And I guess part of that plausibility is, how plausible is it to dislodge Apollo on steroids?
Well, there are really two questions in there, David. One of them is feasible, I think, from a technology point of view, and then feasible from a political point of view. Let me take the technology one first. The Space Dev Dream Chaser manned space transport system, we think, is as elegantly simple a solution as you can come up with. After all, it's based on NASA's HL-20, which is a reverse-engineered Russian BOR-4, BOR-4, which did multiple suborbital and even orbital flights with safe reentry. And then NASA Langley reverse-engineered the BOR-4 into the HL-20, a 10-passenger personnel launch system, and finally dropped the idea in the early 90s. So there's an existing and somewhat proven vehicle design sitting there waiting to be fabricated, and SpaceDev has already developed and proven our safe rocket engines by propelling people to space on multiple occasions in Paul Allen's Spaceship One program. So fabricating an HL-20 and integrating our safe hybrid rocket motors is not as big a stretch as people might think in the beginning. Secondly, it appears as though Elon Musk is very serious about the Falcon 5 and 9, and I like the modular approach he's taking, basically using the motors developed for the Falcon 1, of which we've ordered 3 Falcon 1s at SpaceDev, and essentially combining those motors into clusters. And keep in mind that the Soyuz, the most successful and used launch vehicle in the world, 1,800 launches, uses 32 combustion chambers on each one of its launch vehicles, so the Falcon 9 is not much of a stretch either. Then you have Robert Bigelow with Bigelow Aerospace and a commitment to spend $500 million, if necessary, on developing, perfecting NASA's original idea of the TransHabs, the inflatable modules designed and originally slated to be part of the International Space Station. He seems to be making good progress with his technology, and those are really pretty much all the components, David, is SpaceDev's hybrid rocket motors combined with the HL-20 vehicle, the Falcon 9, and the Bigelow modules, habitats. If those three technologies come into fruition over the next 5 or 6 years, then I think we'll have a low-cost, safe access to the moon, you know, at a price that will be affordable.
I just went to a NASA HL-20 website, so you're going to launch it on top of a Falcon, theoretically?
No, not at all.
Okay.
What we intend to do is hybrid rocket motors are known in the industry as being about the most scalable rocket motors ever. The American Rocket Company, which existed for about 8 years and did 300 test firings of hybrid rocket motors all the way up to the size of 250,000 pounds of thrust. Basically, what we need to do, David, is take that 250,000 pound thrust motor, for which we have all the designs and test data because we acquired all of the AMROC intellectual property in 1998, we only need to scale up by a factor of 4, from 250,000 pounds of thrust to 1,000,000. For Spaceship One, we scaled up by a factor of 1,000. We went from a 15-pound thrust test motor to 15,000 pounds in one step, and we've got a lot of confidence that with the two rocket motor development contracts we currently have with the Air Force, that scaling up and using our hybrid technology on the Dream Chaser is a straightforward exercise, not simple by any means, but, you know, basically just needing the money and the engineering to do.
So I
didn't address the political part.
I was getting ready to go back to that.
Well, David, you know, if you just use common sense, you know, which I know you do, just look at what NASA's trying to do. They're trying to finish the space station, which is $40 billion and counting. They're trying to fly the shuttle 20 more times, which is, you know, over $1 billion per launch. They're trying to develop a crew exploration vehicle, which, you know, who knows what that's going to cost, probably $5 billion or more. A new launch vehicle, the crew launch vehicle, which is probably going to be another $5 billion or more. And then we're talking about the $104 billion return to the moon, and it's Mike Griffin's own characterization of it as Apollo on steroids. You know, I'm not faulting anybody, because what NASA is trying to do is use existing shuttle-based technology and the existing employment base and keep those congressional delegations happy and, you know, use that technology, you know, in the future. But it's not necessarily the safest and least expensive way to go, or the way that's really going to open up space. And I think Mike Griffin knows that, because that seems to be the purpose of his commercial crew cargo program, also called Commercial Orbital Transportation Services, COTS demonstration, where he's trying to say, we will use that shuttle-derived technology as the backup if we need to, but we're going to spend $500 million in the private sector to finance demonstrations of delivering first cargo and then people to the space station. And if the private sector can demonstrate that, then we'll buy that as a service and use the shuttle drive technology as a backup. And if that happens, David, I think that's a major paradigm shift and breakthrough, but we're just going to have to see if that happens or not.
Do you think the program, as it's now described, is going to ultimately be successful and deployed?
I love the program. I've been working with NASA people for over a year and a half, feeding recommendations, comments, and trying to steer this program in a way that it would be fair to smaller businesses. As you probably know, the Federal Acquisition Regulation, the FAR, was implemented supposedly to create fair and open competition. What we usually see in the government, and that's DOD as well as NASA, is open competition, but rarely fair. So it's open in that they make it public and everybody can submit a proposal. They can see the solicitation and submit a proposal. But it's not fair in that a traditional RFP, a request for proposal, for a fairly significant program results in a requirement to spend $250,000 to $5 million or more just preparing a proposal, and there's not a small company around that can afford to do that kind of a proposal. Therefore, the competition is open but unfair. The way NASA is going for this crew cargo contract, this COTS contract, is basically saying, you tell us how you're going to do it. You don't want to comply with man rating, that's okay. Just show us how you're going to assure the safety of people and cargo. Give us milestones. Put a price on the milestones. Don't give us the reams and reams and boxes full of cost data, you know, which, in my opinion, is nonsense, you know, made-up stuff anyway. They're saying, give us a price per milestone. And if we believe you and like your approach, we'll get started with you, but if you fail to meet a milestone, you're out. So it's COD, by the milestone, which is a fairly unique way of doing it. It's not even a FAR-type contract. It's going to be a Space Act contract, you know, which is completely wide open and gives the government total flexibility. So actually, I love the way they're going about it. And we're just going to have to wait and see what kind of proposals are submitted and what kind of companies are selected.
Do you think that the entrepreneurial startup space group of companies can actually perform in that kind of an arena and with that kind of a relationship?
I think that, boy, that's a complicated question.
Let me rephrase it a little bit. Is it almost an arrangement that NASA puts out there knowing that 99.9% of the companies are never going to be able to succeed in it, and therefore they go back to contractors as usual?
Well, I don't think so. I tend to have a little bit of a not necessarily cynical view of what goes on in Washington, but this kind of a realistic view. But I'm also the eternal optimist, David. I am. I can't help but being optimistic about everything. Otherwise, you know, how do you motivate yourself, to plow through this nonsense, year after year after year? So, once again, I'm optimistic that, they're doing things the right way, and this really is an opportunity for companies of all size to participate, although I think the big companies are going to be I think this is kind of detrimental to the, that's not the right way to say it. I don't think this is a very attractive program for big companies, because if there are multiple contracts with a total of $500 million, that sounds like a lot of money, but it's really not for a big company at all. But divide $500 million by four, and, that's a huge amount of money for a small company. So I really do think the opportunity is there, David, but I think that when you really do your due diligence and you look into these small entrepreneurial space companies and you scratch beneath the surface and beneath their snazzy websites and, their PR, and you look at management and you say, what have these founders actually accomplished? What have they gone from concept to hardware in space? What have they done? Show me a successful track record and a real company with real employees that have really built technology and gotten it to space. It's almost zero. And one of the biggest evaluation criteria on this contract is management. So they're not just going to look at pretty proposals. They're going to go beneath the surface. They're going to do the due diligence. They're going to see if the company and the key personnel actually have a successful track record of accomplishing things successfully. And I think if they don't, they're not going to get a contract. Then the question, David, becomes, can the small company that's awarded a contract do it?
That's
a completely different question.
Management is an interesting thing. Does NASA look at requirements for management, say, differently than Wall Street might or a venture capital firm might? Forget that it has to do with space.
I really don't know, because I don't think federal agencies, and I'm not just singling out NASA at all, I don't think federal agencies in these solicitations and proposal evaluations, I don't think they look at that at all. I think they look at maybe the top two or three engineers, or maybe the program manager. You can always find a big-name program manager and throw them in there, but that doesn't mean you're going to be successful if you don't have a company behind it. So I don't think that that's an attribute that is really looked at seriously or in-depth at all by anyone. So if NASA really does it this time, then I think the taxpayers will be rewarded through higher quality contracts that are more likely to succeed rather than just pouring money down a rat hole with entrepreneurs who are just blue smoke and mirrors and arm waving.
So NASA does not have a track record itself of being strong in the due diligence category.
Well, I can't say. Just in my general experience, federal agencies do not look at that as much as they should or as Wall Street would.
Now, what would Wall Street want out of management? What would they expect management to be
that's
like?
That's a mixed bag too, David, because you can argue both ways. You can say that the serious people, who have money at risk, want to see successful track records in all of the key personnel within a company, and that's very often true that they do want to see that. But then when you get one of these waves going on Wall Street, like the dot-com bubble, they don't look at anything. They don't even look at the business plans. They just throw money in because everybody else is. There's a bunch of sheep or lemmings, running toward the cliff. So, it sort of goes both ways. If there's a fad going on, then people don't look at anything. They don't want to be left out, so they just throw money in without, with a blindfold on. And I think in the day-to-day business arena, you have a much more serious approach than, this sort of hype that Wall Street gets caught up in, but there are tens of thousands of businesses, grinding through their, what they do every day, day in and day out, and those are generally benefit from having, key personnel with a good track record of success.
I want to switch the tone for just a little bit, and we're going to take our first break in a minute, but I have an email group of questions coming in, and I want to do one before the break, and this is a group of three short questions from Brian. And his first one is actually a great question. I wonder why I never thought of asking you this. How do you keep your mind fresh because your work must be very demanding? Are you into sports or yoga?
Neither. I'm completely into space dev. That's pretty much all I do.